Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Javed Jabbar, who's a distinguished Pakistani intellectual, author, filmmaker, and activist. He's the chairman and chief executive of JJ Media in Karachi, Pakistan, a firm dedicated to producing distinctive content for diverse media. A former senator and federal minister of Pakistan, he takes an active interest in diverse fields, including international affairs, voluntary work for rural and urban development, the environment, social issues, and mass media. He is associated with conflict resolution and cooperation initiatives between Pakistan and India in the South Asia, and since 1992 has been a member of the longest-running Pakistani-India Track 2 process known as the Neemrana Dialogue. Javed Jabbar's most recent book is Pakistan, Unique Origins, Unique Destiny. Welcome to Background Briefing,
Javed Jabbar. Thank you very much for your name.
Clearly, the relationship between the United States and Pakistan is quite vexed.
Yes.
And I think in many ways a turning point happened recently with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mullen's testimony that was quite blunt, and what was had previously been expressed behind closed doors in terms of frustration between the so-called allies, the U.S. Yes. And Pakistan, came out in the open. And now we have Secretary of State trying to sort of repair things, and
yes.
and she's asking for the Pakistanis, and particularly the military and the ISI, to do things that they so far have not wanted to do. So let's start with that, you know, in terms of the Haqqani network. Is Hillary Clinton's plan, it's actually referred to in American military jargon as fight, talk, and build. Is that dead on arrival?
No. I don't think it's necessarily dead on arrival. Its success will depend on engagement and dialogue with the Taliban. Without wanting to divide the Taliban on the assumption that the Haqqanis can be separated from the main Taliban leadership, that process that Secretary of State Clinton has outlined is dependent on accepting their basic unity of command. If that premise is accepted, then it is possible to continue dialogue. Remember that the first dialogue has already taken place. At Pakistan's suggestion, we facilitated the dialogue because we want dialogue rather than violence to continue. And it is possible to talk, to continue fighting where necessary and unavoidable, if there are outright attacks on U.S. or NATO property. Obviously, the reaction is going to be equally violent, and then build wherever feasible. But the build part has been very, very mixed in areas where corruption is rife, because the war has unleashed a huge amount of corruption. War has become good business, unfortunately, for the people and the society of Afghanistan.
And Pakistan, surely, because the supplies go through Pakistan,
yes,
do they not?
But we are, in one sense, innocent victims. If Pakistanis can be innocent, let me say that we have been innocent victims of being the next door neighbor of Afghanistan. We are locked in by geography. And all of Afghanistan's principal transit imports and exports are through the territory of Pakistan. In fact, we suffer because many goods are imported into Afghanistan and then smuggled back into Pakistan, adversely affecting our own industry and services. So the build part is the key test, whether you can credibly engage the people of Afghanistan side by side with this corruption that has flourished for the past 10 years and reduce the corruption, make sure that facilities, whether they are roads or hospitals or schools, once built, continue functioning. That's the second test, because it's not just enough to put up a structure. What happens inside that structure? And the third phase will be when NATO and the U.S. withdraw, what happens to those structures.
So, isn't that where the impasse is, that where we're talking past, the allies are talking past themselves, in the
yeah.
sense that Pakistan knows that the United States is leaving.
Yeah.
They want influence and stability next door.
Yeah.
And my understanding is that the Haqqanis represent to them a better asset
yeah.
than the Quetta Shura, even. And At least yes. that's
there's a perception that may have been given by some reports. Yeah,
yeah. Well, in the New York Times,
I know,
etc. So, to tell us about what Pakistan wants in terms of filling that vacuum.
First of all, you know, the historic continuity and indispensability of conducting harmonious relations with people in Afghanistan. That is a given. We cannot risk creating new conflicts with people who have always been neighbors and will remain our neighbors, whether the U.S. is present or not present. The fact of ethnicity, language that bind tens of thousands of people who straddle both sides of the border. To give you an idea, there are villages in at least three locations on the Afghanistan-Pakistan border where villages are divided right down the middle. Half of the village is in Afghanistan, half in Pakistan. Now, that's how closely integrated these communities have been. And to live as two independent nation states has never been easy. Afghanistan, incidentally, was the only country in 1947 which opposed the application of Pakistan for admission to the United Nations. They withdrew the objection after 3 months, but that gives you an indication of how hypersensitive and complex the relationship is. So we want a stable and harmonious Afghanistan. But for that to happen, as I said earlier, we don't think it is useful for the U.S. to pursue a policy where the Haqqanis and what is called the Quetta Shura, the other leadership of the Taliban, can be separated. We think that we should respect the fact that even the Haqqanis have said publicly that we will not have a dialogue outside the discipline of the Taliban leadership. So if we accept that they are part of the same entity, it will help and facilitate matters. To the extent that you can have purposeful dialogue where viewpoints are so diametrically opposite to each other in terms of the time frame for withdrawal, that is the key. How and when and how quickly there is an agreement on a smooth withdrawal of forces.
But throughout this conversation, Javed Jabbar, we haven't even talked about the government of Afghanistan. And so where does that fit in? I mean, what is Pakistan's attitude to Karzai? He went to India to make a strategic arrangement, about details of which are still very opaque. We're not even talking about them. We're talking about the so-called enemy of the United States and of Pakistan. So tell us about what's going to happen with this current government, whether it's fictional or not. It's still there.
Yes, the current government of Afghanistan has gone through some phases of very interesting evolution. In the beginning, it disproportionately included representatives of the Northern Alliance, who are Tajiks or Uzbeks or Hazaras by ethnic identity, and do not represent the overwhelming majority of Pashtuns. And it was at Pakistan's constant urging that President Karzai corrected the imbalance in his cabinet and gave greater representation to his own Pashtuns. So that helped improve matters, both from Afghanistan's point of view and our viewpoint. As regards the recent visit to New Delhi, while elements of this visit disturbed us because of its timing and some of the pronouncements that he made, lo and behold, 3 days later, he makes the startling announcement, startling even to us, where he says that if there were a war between the United States and Pakistan, Afghanistan would side with Pakistan. Now, that should...
that's a surprise, but is there going to be a war?
No.
I mean, it seems, you know, you can argue that the U.S. has done some stupid things, the invasion of Iraq being one of the most pronounced acts of stupidity in recent geopolitical history.
True.
It seems to me that there's no chance in the world that the U.S. is going to they want the cooperation of Pakistan. They don't want the enmity. I mean, they may be frustrated with the relationship, but I can't imagine they want it to get it worse. So what's Karzai talking about?
Exactly. One would like to know. I mean, one would like to know what he means by this, I'm sorry to say, a very absurd statement, because there is no question of either the people or the government of Pakistan wanting a war with the United States. It would be insane. It would be against our fundamental interests. And forget interests. It would be against our orientation and our attitude to the United States. Contrary to the impression that you might get or hear about, that there is anti-Americanism in Pakistan, that people burn U.S. flags or they burn effigies of U.S. leaders, the overwhelming majority of the people respect the United States for what it is. It's a very dynamic, creative society, and they recognize the fact that it is a global power. It would not be in their interest. It would not be in the interest of the future of Pakistan to go to war. And in any case, the inequality of both countries is so great, there's no question of it being a fair war, if ever there is such a thing as a fair war.
Sure. Pakistan's got India to worry about. Yes, they don't need to pick a fight
absolutely.
With their ally. Now,
yeah,
it does, I agree. I think manifestly makes no sense.
Yeah.
Again, I'm speaking with Javed Jabbar, a distinguished Pakistani intellectual, author, filmmaker, and activist. He's chairman and chief executive of JJ Media in Karachi, Pakistan, and a former senator and federal minister of Pakistan. You've also been, since 1992, a member of the longest-running Pakistan-India Track 2 process known as the Nimrana Dialogue.
Yes.
So it's hardly a coincidence that whenever or when the Pakistani leadership and the civilian leadership and the Indian leadership were poised to get together, there was the Mumbai attack. I mean, we know there's a mechanism that goes on here that frustrates it. We also know that there's a tremendous intransigence on the part of India over Kashmir because the late U.S. Representative, Special Representative Richard Holbrooke, who was given the job of being he understood that the job of being Special Envoy to Pakistan and Afghanistan made no sense unless you went straight for Kashmir. Yeah. If you solve that problem, then all these other problems go away. So tell me about any possibility of a macro deal there.
It is probably the most complex relationship. The India-Pakistan relationship probably is unmatched by the relationship of any other two states in the world today. It is full of nuance, complexity, conflicts. However, there is hope and scope. Despite the perverse timing of some of these terrorist attacks, which want to subvert the state's desire or the government's desire to come to peace with India, there is a large amount of goodwill and familiarity on both sides of the border to initiate and sustain. The important thing is to sustain dialogue, regardless of these incidents. If the U.S. and Vietnam, North Vietnam, could talk in Paris while bombing continued in North Vietnam, these two sides can continue regardless of whether terrorists want to hold us hostage or otherwise. And I'm happy to report that in the last few months, the commerce ministers of both countries, for example, have met and have advanced the prospects for trade in unprecedented ways. And trade has been growing despite the political tensions. Now, even on the political front, both governments have agreed to conduct continuous dialogue. And especially on Kashmir, our Track 2 process had helped create a framework which could be used by governments, and we don't want to claim any credit for it. Ultimate credit must go to the two governments. We had created a basis for which back-channel diplomacy, where one person alone is designated by each head of government to conduct super-secret dialogue. Because of the sensitivity of this issue, these cannot be discussed, the terms of settlement, before there is basic agreement. And those four elements we have identified make it possible for both governments to take this process forward. And in case you want to ask me for those four, I'll do that. Otherwise, we can always...
Well, I just wanted to, because we're running out of time, to get a broader sense of the dynamics of whether the economic self-interest, particularly with energy coming out of the stands, which both countries could benefit from. Obviously, the pipelines would have to transit Pakistan to get to India.
True.
There's a lot of reasons why the two countries have an economic self-interest in stability.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, all conspiracy theories about oil pipelines notwithstanding, there's no way that you're going to have a sustainable oil pipeline through any country that's at war because they're so easy to sabotage.
Right.
So we know that you have elements in the Pakistani military that need to justify their existence by constant tension, and the same I'm sure applies on the Indian side because that's the nature of military. You know, the Pentagon here has to justify its massive budget where we outspend the world combined. Mm-hmm. And they're resisting any cuts at this moment. So that's the picture that I wanted to get. It's who's going to win, commercial interests or military intransigence?
To speak for the much maligned poor military, if the military can be poor by any standards, it's rarely poor in any part of the world. But may I say that on the basis of interactions regularly with the military, retired and serving, I serve as a member of what is called the Civil Military Dialogue Group. Our military is to some considerable extent misunderstood. The very genesis of Pakistan was so insecure. The only nation-state created with two wings separated by 1,000 miles of hostile territory. I like to give the example. Can you visualize the United States being born with New York on one end, California on the other, and the Soviet Union in the middle? Imagine the kind of insecurity New York and California would have felt. That's what we felt in 1947, because the Indian government was on record as saying, the Home Minister of India said, Pakistan won't last more than 6 months. Now, if you have that kind of attitude, right from the word go, the military became the guarantee of national survival and security. And even after 71, when we lost half our country, mainly due to our own blunders, but also due to active Indian help, we resolved to secure our identity and our continuity. And when India introduced nuclear weapons, we had no choice but to also develop nuclear weapon capacity. At this time, the military actively supports the peace process with India. They recognize that it is going to be wasteful, non-productive to constantly engage in tension with India. The onus, and I'm not trying to pass the buck, the onus lies on India. It is 3 times the size of our armed forces. It is 7 to 8 times the size of our population. 60% to 70% of its armed forces are deployed on the Pakistan border. So we have no choice but to wait for India to make that move. But on energy, let me say that I was very disappointed that the U.S. did not actively support the proposal for an Iran-Pakistan-India gas pipeline. Now, one respects America's reservations with Iran, even though I disagree with the mutual lack of perception and dialogue. But that could have been a very salutary project where you bring together 3 immediate countries, Iran, Pakistan, India, and that could well have helped improve relations even with the United States. So energy, certainly. Incidentally, we are sitting on one of the world's largest coal deposits, and India uses coal on a very significant scale. Coal for us is only a small percentage of our energy consumption. We could benefit by joint ventures with India in developing coal, clean coal, and we could benefit from U.S. advice because I believe clean coal is a major concern in U.S. energy plans. And therefore, also with the Tans, as you mentioned, the oil pipeline, but stability in Afghanistan is a prerequisite for any pipeline to run through Afghanistan into Pakistan.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time and we've barely scratched the surface of this complex and relationship between these two countries, not to mention the complexities of Pakistan itself.
Yes.
But I do thank you for joining us, Javed Jabbar.
Thank you very much for your hospitality.
Again, I've been speaking with Javed Jabbar, distinguished Pakistani intellectual, author, filmmaker and activist. He's chairman and chief executive of JJ Media in Karachi, Pakistan. He's a former senator and federal minister in Pakistan, and since 1992 has been a member of the longest-running Pakistan-India Track 2 process known as the Neem Rana Dialogue. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.